We all like to think we're making smart money decisions, but half the time, it's actually our unconscious brain in the driving seat, and that can mean accidental sabotage. So welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee. I'm Frances Cook, a financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. And maybe you've told yourself, I'm just not a money person. Maybe you're convinced that you're bad with money, when really, you're already doing plenty of things right. Just a couple of small tweaks could be all that's needed to get you back on the right track. The stories that we tell ourselves about money can hold us back, can keep us stuck, and even sabotage our finances. So today, we're tackling the biggest money myths and how to smash them with money coach Amanda Morrell. All right, welcome in, Amanda Morrell. Look, you have been in the financial world for a long time on a few different things. You've been a financial journalist, a financial commentator, also worked in the financial industry, and now you are a financial coach, which we were talking a little bit off mic before. You definitely have more patience than me because I think I would find that probably the hardest of the jobs that I've just rattled off. But you must see this a lot where people come to you and they've got issues with money, but there is that old standard thing of 20% of money is numbers and 80% of it is mindset. From the work you've done, do you think that's accurate?
I may even say it's higher, that 90% is mindset and 10%. I mean, there's some mechanical aspects of money, which actually aren't all that difficult, but because of the psychology towards money, a lot of people have just sort of tripped themselves in various places, which is unfortunate. So that's sort of that first obstacle that we have to kind of unpack and, rearrange for a lot of clients.
Yeah, I'll bet. And it's tricky, right? Because I think you always want to acknowledge the reality of where people are coming from with money. And there can be very real things that hold us back. We all start in different places. There can be different issues. But at the same time, to say, oh, it's your mindset, it can sound really woo and yet true. How do we balance those two things so that people are ready to talk to us about mindset and not feel like it's just something fluffy?
I think maybe not calling it mindset and just trying to get people to see that where they are with their money is just a symbolic of what's been happening in their life in general, because you can't really separate the two, right? So I think when you get people to zoom out a little bit to see that this isn't, separate from you and your life, but it's a creation of what you've been doing with your life. And then they kind of put a different lens on it. And so, well, mindset's a really efficient way of kind of languaging it. It's just a little bit bigger than that. And so, it's just helping people to identify how they're regarding their money and treating their money and appreciating the life events that have got them in the various positions. Because it's quite often these big events in life that trigger it, a divorce, or you've got to get insurance, or you've just gone flatting, or you've had a car accident, you didn't have the emergency fund. So it's usually events that trigger it, but then you kind of, again, step back and see where you're at that got you to the place where you don't have those extra funds, or, you've got excess funds, and what do you do with them?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I just did an episode recently on how to find a financial advisor, and one of the first things I wanted to talk about was, do you even need a financial advisor? And it's often those big life events that maybe you do need to check in and reassess, and it makes life all a bit real. But then again, like we say, is, addressing what you even want from life, and that mindset piece all comes into that. Do you think the stories we tell ourselves, and again, this is going to sound fluffy, but we do tell ourselves stories about who we are, where we come from, where we're going. Do you think they can shape how we interact with money, both good and bad?
100%, because you kind of convince yourself or brainwash yourself of one story and your relationship with money, and then that affects everything, right? So again, it's almost like you need a therapist more than, a financial advisor, because they're going to help to shine a light on some of those dark spots in your mind or just blind spots, rather, to help you kind of view it in a different way. And so it's really a lot more productive, have a deeper conversation, which is harder, particularly when you've got a limited amount of time. And it depends how complex somebody's situation is too, to get them to make certain steps, certain mental adjustments to make a transformation in their life with regards to how they treat money. So it is tricky, you know, and I'm learning about that too, because everybody's different. But you know, you cannot separate the two. They're you know, who you are, how you behave, how you look at things, and then what you do with this little pot that you have or don't have.
Yeah. Do you know what's really funny is, like, obviously I've been in the money and the personal finance space a while, so I've done a lot of this work on myself just sort of over the years, little bit by little bit. But coming into now that I run my own business, that has been quite a shift, and it has made me reframe things a lot in a very similar way to, I imagine, what people would reframe their money the way you're talking about here. I was just talking about before that I got a business coaching session, and shocked me how much it was actually more like therapy. And that sort of 3/4 of the way through this first session, she was like, "Are you picking up on a theme for anything that we're talking about?" And I was like, "Yeah, my whole business is driven by anxiety. Like, what's going on here? This can't be good." And she was like, "Well, you know, we're going to start off. We're going to thank your anxiety. It's helped you do some good things." And I was like, "Oh my God, this feels so fluffy. I hate it." But it was actually really interesting and true. And I've had so many moments since then where, as I've been making decisions, I've been like, hang on, is this anxiety driven? Is this real? Is this useful anxiety? It doesn't always have to be bad. Is this a useful anxiety that can push me forward? Or is this unhelpful? And it's really reframed things. And I imagine that's how a lot of people feel when they're coming into the personal finance for the first time and having to think about these things. I mean, what do you think in terms of common myths and things that often hold people back when you're working with clients? Is there something that comes up a lot?
So I'm working with a lot of women, and women typically, you mentioned your own experience with sort of the business thing. So with women in particular, they seem to get really tripped up by thinking that they should be better than they are, or they think they're not good for whatever reason. And just a little bit of apprehension about getting to the place that they would like to get and giving themselves permission. So there's a lot of minimization about, you know, the skill set that they might have, or the habits that they might have already adopted, or what they've already learned. And again, I think that they expect that they should be this, you know, whatever that, you know, Sheryl Sandberg kind of person. And it's like, you don't have to be that. What do you want to be, and where do you want to go? And let's separate these crazy high expectations you might have from a more realistic interpretation of where you want to go and what you're, where you're currently at. We really underrate our ability and, you know, prospects with money. So it's kind of like giving yourself permission, hey, you know what, you're doing just great. Let's look at what you do already have and already know, and let's dream about what you want to achieve. Forget about, you know, the dream that the neighbor has, or the lifestyle that, you know, Susie has down the road, which is maybe debt funded. It's like, what do you want? And that can be the more challenging part too, with people, you know, having that real sort of insight and reflection point to say, yeah, what do I want out of life? What's meaningful to me, and you know, what's achievable, and how much money do I need to do that? Quite often, if you strip it all down, what they're really trying to achieve is more realistic than they would have thought, because you don't need $1 billion to be happy.
I love that, because this is something I talk to people about all the time, where I think people often want a one-size-fits-all solution. You know, how do I do well with money? Okay, you do this. Whereas, what do you want out of life would totally change that. And that's why, you know, we've got disclaimers on this podcast saying this is general information. If you want an individual financial plan, you need to talk to a financial advisor. And that's not just a legal thing. The reason that is a legal thing is because we want different things out of life, and we have different ways that could work for us to do it. And of course, you know, I'm sure we all have friends who live their lives differently from us. So of course our money lives will be different. But when you're trying to help people figure that out, I think saying, what do you want out of life, is kind of a harder question than you would think, right?
It's really hard. I've got one woman who's, you know, just come into, you know, some money. She just finished a really acrimonious divorce. And, you know, the foundation of our conversation is that, well, what do you want to do? Like, what do you enjoy doing with your spare time? How do you want to? And she couldn't even get to you know, to answer those questions, because she hadn't given herself time. She'd been so caught up in the, you know, the treadmill of life, of, you know, being a mom and working, and no bandwidth at all to, you know. So I really like had to challenge her. I was like, do you like gardening? Do you like going for walks? Do you, you know, because she just simply had been so caught up in her own, the immediacy of just survival, that she hadn't gotten to that point, which is quite, you know, sad, because really this is a finite life that we have here. You want to be able to enjoy it. And that's what money, you know, can do for you, is provide you with some options to do the things you would like to do. So that's quite a confronting question for some people. And maybe it seems obvious to some that they found their passions already, or they, you know, they just have, you know, realized that their families are everything and they want more time with their families and those kind of things. But you'd be surprised just how many people kind of are lost in the fog of, you know, what do I want out of this short life that I have? And so this is what I'm saying, is this is quite often, it's a little bit of therapy going on there before you get to the mechanics. Because once you, you know, that part is easy. And you've probably found that too, about, you know, where's the highest interest rate, or do you have debt? Those kind of things are actually simple. It's the more philosophical, meaty issues of life that are integral to what you want to do with money that you need to unpack.
Where do you start those conversations with people? One thing I found useful was like literally just being like, if you won Lotto tomorrow, what would you do? And that often is quite clarifying for people, because a lot of people do have that Lotto dream of, I'd go traveling, or I'd pay off the house, or I'd pay off my parents' house. Or, you know, it kind of focuses the mind in a way of, okay, there's your values, and work backwards from there. What version of that can you have? But I mean, is there that technique or a different technique that you use to help people hone in on what do you want, and then how do we work backwards from that?
And like, everybody's different. So, you know, you could frame that question for some people and they'll just be like a deer caught in the headlights, and others would know immediately because they've spent nights awake thinking and dreaming about what it is they want to do. One of the things I think women are quite good at is we're intuitive, being able to kind of, you know, grasp the essence of where people are at with their lives, just trying to harness into that and then develop the appropriate language. And then try to, you know, again, rearrange the pieces on the chessboard for them. So that's conversational, just like what we're having here now, and getting, you know, building trust too. That's part of a trust relationship. And you don't always get there immediately, you know, but I find my years of being a journalist and talking to people, and that's one thing journalism does for you, is you learn how to get people to open up to you. Probably in an efficient way, because you don't have hours and hours to do that over, you know, a coaching session of 30 minutes or an hour. But I think those things have actually been equipped me well for what I would like to do today. So, you know, I think it was Steve Jobs who said at some convocation ceremony, it's only looking back that you see all the dots, how they were connected to get you to you where you are now. And so I think when you kind of looked at my sort of collective experience in the industry, et cetera, I feel like all those little steps connected the dots to get me where I'm here. And so for me, those are resources that I can help to bring to clients.
It's interesting that, isn't it? And I want to come back to what you do in a second, but what you've touched on there is a little bit of a passion of mine. So I'm just going to dive off on the side with you, because I don't think many people have a job for life anymore. And you certainly have really mixed and matched the different career steps that you've taken. They're in a similar zone, but they're very different roles within that. I mean, do you think, I'm a big believer that no experience is ever wasted, and that we end up bringing them into new ways. And when you can combine different skills in a unique way, that's when you bring such high value to something. But do you think that's going to be the future of work a little bit, bringing these really diverse experiences and kind of creating these unique roles for ourselves as we progress through our careers?
It's really hard to know what's going on. And, you know, I hate to bring in the AI thing, but, you know, that can be an assistive tool, but also a real liability, particularly as people who've been in a particular career pathway are now saying, well, that's going to completely displace me. So now where does that leave me? So that one is a bit of an unknown. But yeah, for me personally, I could never see myself doing one job for 35 or 40 years. So I've always had twin passions. One is sort of a strand of, Eastern philosophy, yoga and Buddhism. The other strand has been, you know, finance and journalism. And I've struggled to see how those pathways kind of can integrate. But, you know, they're starting to kind of merge now for me, which is great. And, you know, it won't be everybody's cup of tea, but I certainly see that there's components of one that feed into the next. And again, to help people to see that you can't separate your money from, you know, that internal world. And in my book, it's quite old now, but, you know, I suggested it's not until you do the internal work that you're going to get the settings right on the outside. And that's very much sort of, you know, an Eastern philosophical idea that you do the inside work first and then work outwards. And I think that traditional way of thinking, oh, well, yeah, this 9-to-5 job and this is that and segmenting everything, I think that that will kind of blow apart in the future. But, you know, who knows? It's so crazy right now to forecast anything.
Yes, it feels like it's all changing so fast and every which way. It's interesting that you mentioned that, actually, in terms of the Buddhism and the philosophy point of view, because I've seen you talk a lot about, I mean, it's brilliant. I love following your work. You still do a lot of commentary. And you've talked a lot about making sure that your money reflects your values and that sort of the idea of the money with meaning and building a meaningful life, using your money to do that. How do you think... Because I do think there is a little bit, this is one of the myths that I think comes up, that money is for greedy people or that it is, you know, anytime you're involved in capitalism, you know, there's no sort of good guys under capitalism. And I know we're all in an imperfect world and an imperfect system. I'd sometimes wake up and look at the headlines and wish I didn't. But at the same time, I do think you can control your little corner of the world and make sure that your money is meaningful and your money reflects your values. How much work do you think that takes and what sort of things do people need to do in order to be achieving that? Living a good monetary life, but in a way that reflects their values and the things they want to see in the world.
Yeah, I'll just give you one example, and hopefully it's on point with you know, a particular young woman that I was working with, and she was very apologetic, suggesting she was bad with money. She didn't want to do this. She would do things for free. And she was getting a lot of income at the time. And again, so there was a minimization of her skill set, minimization of what money could do. The penny dropped when she started to get this huge refund. And she realized that this particular little pot of money for her was going to, even though she didn't need it, she'd be able to help her a family member and do some other things. So then you could see that there's a mindset shift that with additional money coming through and it's properly managed, that you can do wonderful things to help other people. If it's not helping yourself to buy, you know, whatever gadgetry or material goods you might think. So I think that can be a pivotal shift when people, you know, realize if you know, their own means are met, that they can do things for other people. And that's quite a beautiful thing to be in that position. And I just going back to that original sort of statement you made about, you know, money being bad or capitalism, this, that, I always used to have, you know, when I was younger in my 20s, this idea too that, you know, wealthy people were, you know, selfish or, you know, so I had this dirty view of money myself, which biased my thinking about whether I should be more aspirational with my money. And I've certainly shifted that now. I mean, I don't have goals to be a billionaire myself, but, you know, again, if, you know, I got 10x the amount of wealth that I would have, you know, for me, I think about all the wonderful things I could do to help others, you know, because I know I've been down that journey about what will make me happy and how much is enough. And there's this wonderful book by Arun Abbey about how much is enough, about when you make your threshold amount, then what, you know, and how much do you really need to lead a meaningful life? So for people at the other end of the journey, you know, where they've grown their wealth and they've got investment portfolios and the mortgages paid off, they reach that sort of beautiful stage in life where they can start contemplating those questions. And for some other people at the end of the other end of the track, I know that seems all probably just too far-fetched for them to even think about. So that's sort of the trajectory that you go from when you're starting from, you know, like square one, like snakes and ladders, versus you're getting to the top of the game, you're almost out.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? This is not something said to brag. This is to give a concrete example. You know, I think about how things have changed for me. And, you know, I'm also not a billionaire. No desire to be. I feel like when you hit too much money, it does mess with you a little bit. But to have a certain amount of financial security is incredible. And the way I've been able to help some people in my life You know, I had a friend who had a baby, was really struggling with something. She was on maternity leave, had no money for the fix. And I was able to just say, babe, do you want a hand? Like, I can help you with that. It's no problem. And it was genuinely no problem as well. It wasn't like a huge sum of money, but it was something I could help with. And it was massive for her family. And little things like that that have sprinkled through life, to be able to be that person to steps up and says, do you need a hand? I can. Has been hugely meaningful to me, and more so than, you know, we're also hoping to pay off the mortgage early, which, don't get me wrong, there'll be bubbles when that happens. But I don't know if it'll hit the same way as being able to help out people around me. It's interesting that you mentioned, though, the woman that you were dealing with who said, you know, that she was it that she wasn't a money person or she wasn't good with money? Yeah, that's such a common one, right? Where do you think those sorts of limiting beliefs come from? Because that is a limiting belief that I see all the time. And then you dig into it with people and it's very often not true.
It's just a deception of the mind, really, because, you know, I think it comes from that place of having an idea in your head about what being good with money is. And I think people have an idea in their head that being good with money means you're good at math. Maybe you drive a flash car, you've got a corporate job, and, you know, you live in a flash house. I don't know. But I think there's an idea of that versus the reality of it is like, okay, how are you operating and what are your behaviors and habits with the money that you own? Forget about, you know, the person down the street. And are you managing that effectively? So again, there's this slow unraveling of people begin to kind of redefine, you know, their relationship with money. And in the case of this one young woman, you know, she shopped at op shops and she drove a secondhand car and she was happy with that. She only wanted to upgrade the car so she could drive her sister's new baby, her nephew or niece around. And so I was quite surprised by that because her ambitions were probably quite modest in relative terms. But she, again, had some narrative in her head that she needed to be, you know, this kind of person, whereas, you know, she had all the habits and behaviors of somebody actually is good with money. So I think that disconnect comes from thinking that you should be something and just the reality of seeing that, you know, what's in front of you and how you, your daily spending habits and your disciplines and, you know, conduct in the world is actually what it is. So it's kind of flipping the equation, right? So maybe it's, you know, the financial industry doesn't do itself any favors using all this language and jargon too, that sort of people like, what's that? And so again, that also gives people the view that they don't know or understand money. And, you know, we could use KiwiSaver as a good example of that, where it's convoluted language that people are just kind of confused by it. And therefore they default to thinking, oh, bad with money. I don't understand investments.
Yeah, oh, so true. Because often as well, a lot of that complicated language is used to describe very simple things. I'm like, guys, why do we need to do this? Like, we really don't need to be using these big words for very simple ideas and very simple techniques. I mean, when you're helping people rebuild that confidence, because I do feel like confidence with money is a big part of making good choices. So when you're helping people rebuild that confidence so they can start working towards goals, how do you start uncovering some of the things that they are actually doing well?
I think you got to kind of lay out all the pieces again. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, it's like you find the edges and then you kind of work your way in and put the colors together that are matching and then shine a light on it for them too. And again, it's going to be different for every single person that, you know, I haven't seen anybody who's got an identical problem or situation in life. It's different from everybody. So again, you got to like adjust the conversation to meet the person where they're at. And then, like, look at their situation. All the situations are very different, and you know, find out, you know, what is the vision, what is the image, what's the dream that you have for yourself. So it's quite intense in some regards. So it goes beyond simple, like, you know, am I in the right KiwiSaver fund kind of dilemma, you know, because when you achieve certain little measures or, you know, achievements with your finances, then it becomes like, okay, next step, you're moving up, like the snakes and ladders thing, right? You're moving up. So now what? And how do you prevent from sliding back down?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Do you have an example of a mindset shift that you've helped someone make that has maybe unlocked a change in their finances as well?
You know, I've got one particular client, she's got quite a lot of wealth and there's trust, and sadly, you know, somebody passed away and everything and felt that she couldn't, you know, touch this money because it was tainted. And, you know, so there was a sort of like a bias on the money itself and, you know, whose money it was, what you do, and then having to make decisions around how that money is invested. But like, so there was just a view that she shouldn't be able to touch or rearrange or do something different with this money because she didn't feel that it was hers, you know, and that's just a psychological trap, right?
Yeah. So how'd you break through that with her?
You get people just sort of pause. And some of these things are very emotionally, you know, laden, like inheritances, for example, you know, also very sensitive. You know, I didn't make this money, so is it mine to spend? They're tricky. You know, you're not going to solve these things overnight because, you know, very seldom you're going to go into one therapy session, for example, and fix somebody's outlook, right? So it's just slowly planting seeds and shifting and, you know.
If someone's working off a myth that is holding them back, or they've maybe got a bad habit with money that they are trying to break, where do you start on breaking some of those negative cycles?
It's the people who actually have the most money, I think, that have the biggest hang-ups quite often. Well, I guess you could find that there's a debt issues at the other end of the scale. But I feel like some people don't give some permission to spend. And you'll see it. It's a generational thing, too. You know, if at the other end of the scale, you've got, you know, depression era people, and there'd be, you know, like people like my parents and stuff like that were very frugal, you know, because they realize that money is scarce. They've been through big life events and, you know, they're not, you know, their lives will end soon. And it's like giving them permission to spend. Like I'll give my dad an example. Like, you know, he's doing very well. He's still working. He's in his 80s. He doesn't need to work. He could have retired years ago, you know, and he struggles to walk. And I'm encouraging him to, you know, upgrade himself when he's flying all the way from Canada to visit me.
Oh my God, this was a huge, that's a long flight.
This was a huge thing for him. And he's finally sort of broken through to like he can afford it and to like treat himself to premium economy. And he's really thankful for that. And, you know, these things seem really basic, you know, but, you know, he had the means to do it, but just the mindset was holding him back. So that's one example, you know, or not turning on the heaters. You living in a house that's cold and you've got indoor, you know, lovely central heating and you can, you know, why wouldn't you to make your life a little bit more comfortable? But, you know, and those disciplines will reward you, obviously. That's why a lot of people get wealthy because they're not extravagant or excessive, but they could probably afford to tune up the dial a little bit and on the little bit on the indulgent side. But, you know, they have to ease off, you know, and this is not, you know, for most people, these are probably trivial things that aren't going to make or break their situation. But
maybe, but it's also quality of life, right? Because it's one skill to make money, save money, invest money. Those are great skills. It's also a skill to spend money in a way that adds to your life. The point of having money is not to hoard it like Smaug the dragon and just sit on your little hoard of gold and be like so pleased with yourself. The point is to build a nice life that you enjoy. And obviously you want security as part of that. Obviously savings and investments really help. But to know how to spend it, also a skill. And I think that's a really good point. When you're older and at the end of your life, sorry to say that about your dad, but you know, getting towards the end of things, oh my word, enjoy things, please.
No, I'm constantly telling them that. But I guess when you've got really entrenched habits, and I get it, you know, for that generation, it's really hard to let go of those things, right? And the older you get, the more, you know, stuck in you get with your attitude. So it's horses for courses with, you know, where you're at in, you know, your financial situation. And, you know, at the other end of the scale, you've got people who have got, you know, maybe more modest means, but then, you know, doing things that they shouldn't do, Afterpay or the credit cards. And then, you know, they complain we're not having money, but they're just lacking the discipline that maybe, you know, like the, you know, Depression era kids had to grow their wealth. It's very challenging for younger people today. I mean, you know, I'm older than you, but like when I was, you know, in my 20s, you know, these expensive phones and, you know, going on expensive holiday, you know, all this stuff that now is like sort of believed to be, you know, commonplace or expected lifestyle shifts. They just weren't there, like dating myself. But, you know, you worked, you know, a couple of years to save up money for a holiday. It was an annual thing or, you know, every 3 months to go on. You know, it was a really special thing. But I think the expectations are very high for what the lifestyle, you know, the dream lifestyle should be for a lot of younger people. And it's an expensive one. So they're at a kind of a different stage of the game, where, you know, a lot of them are way overspending compared to what they're actually, you know, earning, and need to apply some strict disciplines. But, you know, again, expectations, what they see others doing, the lifestyles that are portrayed on Instagram and the like, you know, they think that that's where they should be headed. And so I, very, very different situation from, you know, the other generation. They just need to rein it in and listen to their elders.
Yeah.
That'll be me soon.
There we go. That's going to get you trolled.
Well, it's true though, right? So like we can, this is what I, you know, the older I get, I kind of really try to absorb and appreciate the lessons of people who've gone ahead of me, because there's lessons to learn from people who've gone, you know, down that track. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, isn't it? I do feel like all the generations could pick something up from each other. As you were saying, you know, the older generation who maybe could do to let go a little bit and enjoy a little bit more of life, versus maybe like they could learn that from the younger generation. The younger generation could pick up how to, you know, buy 20 bars of soap and stick them under the sink and bulk buy some Costco. Yeah, no, it's tricky that, isn't it? What about yourself? Is there anything, you know, I've certainly found as I've spent more and more time talking about money, learning about money, there's still something I learn on a weekly basis. And I love that about this job, talking to interesting people, picking up new things. Is there anything, a mindset shift or a myth that you've confronted or a story that you had in your brain that you've tackled that for yourself and it's made a difference for you?
Again, I had a perception in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s that, you know, money not was evil, but that, you know, there's something uncomfortable about it. I've sort of let go of that, because now I can see that, you know, that you're, you know, with extra money or wealth in your life, you can help out a lot of people, you know, help people out. And I'm really thankful for that. And so that's, My mother was my best mentor with money, and she probably was very frustrated with me when she was trying to like lead a horse to water earlier and take a business course. Why did you do that? I was like, no. So it wasn't until later, probably when I, you know, in my sort of late 30s, and when I moved to New Zealand, that I really kind of found myself in this space. And so I constantly reflect and hear her. She's passed on, but, you know, some of the lessons, and I can hear her voice in my head about, you know, the empowerment that you get from, you know, having greater wealth in your life. And I see that now and I'm embracing it. So that was a big step change for me. Money's meant to make your life easier, you know, where I was kind of getting all, not hoarding, but just very careful. And so I still am very quite careful with my money. I wouldn't say I'm frugal, but I've had to kind of like, now that I'm in a better position, just sort of like, you know, let go of the reins a little bit. And fortunately, I think I've gone through that evaluation about what is meaningful, what's valuable to me. I'm not a terribly materialistic person or anything. So I know that, you know, buying the shiny new things or this or that or the handbag, that will not make me happy. Seldom have I gone out and bought something for myself and then 48 hours later, you know, haven't said, oh, I don't know why I did that. So I have, you know, I've got those disciplines where I don't like, you know, buy an impulse. I don't buy to fill an emotional void. You know, so, but, you know, a lot of people don't, and that they're just quite often the consumerism is just a way of filling a void inside, which is where people get into trouble.
Oh my God. Speaking of anxiety, right? Like I have that happen all the time and I'm aware of it. And I think being aware of it has been very helpful. But, you know, if I'll often do events and things where people will get me to MC or to speak, really fun, love being around people, often get so anxious ahead of time because it's very fancy people in these rooms. And I know I'm feeling anxious if I have the urge to go out and buy a new outfit. Because for some reason, that'll be my armor that makes me fit in and I'll look good and I'll feel good and blah, blah, blah. All of it is a lie. I have perfectly good outfits already in my wardrobe. I will be fine. The people there will be lovely. They've literally invited me there. They want me to be there, but I'm getting anxious and freaking out. And the way it comes out is I have this overwhelming urge that I must go and buy an outfit now. And so it's been very, very helpful for me just to know that that's my process. Okay, babe, we're feeling a bit anxious about this. You'll be fine. But these little things creep up on you and it can feel like the solution is to spend money, right? And yet the solution is often to acknowledge how we're feeling and maybe have a cup of tea and spend some time with the kids or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
100%. You just quite like for people in that situation, and you probably just face it, you know, in these glam events, and maybe, you know, it's great you expanded your wardrobe, but some people, the frequency of these things is like very high. And, you know, you hear stories too about people who've got shopping bags in their closet that they haven't even. So it can be an illness really at the extreme level. But I think the point at which people, you know, when you arrived at it too and you realized, no, you know, hang on, and you've got that moment of self-realization, that's a huge breakthrough moment because you can just, you know, take a breath, reevaluate your wardrobe, look at your balance. Okay, well, you know, and then make a more considered approach to it. But the temptations these days, again, because of so much social anxiety and bye, and then buy now, pay later, all that stuff. You know, it's a really difficult period of time for people to navigate when there's so much cool stuff out there to buy, really, and all the temptations. And, you know, on the other hand, a lot of, you know, social disturbances and emotional disturbances in people's lives. And that's what I see now more than ever is these, you know, emotional disturbances because of just kind of the crazy stuff that's going out in the world.
Yeah. How much does that reflect in people's money? How do you see that crop up? I mean, obviously there's things like the buying to fill the void. Are there other things that people do to cope with not feeling good? Does it pop up in other areas too?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you know, substance abuse.
Yeah.
You know, vaping's very expensive. You know, so that can eat up your whole budget because that's in a form of escapism, right? So there's the, you know, get all buy the latest this, that, and the other thing. And then there's the I don't want to feel anything, you know, and that can be a financial liability and a complete emotional, you know, self-sabotaging and physical self-sabotaging kind of aspect. So again, you know, maybe you don't want to see that as being personal finance, but they get bundled up. So you can't separate again the person from the money and their habits and the psychology. It's all together.
How do you start helping people with that?
You can only do so much, right? So if somebody presents with a financial difficulty and you try to unpack about why they got, you know, what is the problem here? How they got to that problem? How are they going to get out of that problem? You know, again, I'm not a miracle worker and I've only got so much time in the day. So you want to help, at least my sort of where I get meaning out of life is trying to help people get in a better position. But I also have to be realistic about what I can and can't do, you know. As I'm sure you can. I mean, you're giving people information. They're hopefully going to, you know, build up their own body of knowledge and make better decisions as a result. And the people that are listening or watching are going to be those people. The people who probably need it the most are not quite there yet. So again, you just have to kind of wait. When the student is ready, the master will appear.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's the case with a lot of people. They have to be ready to step up.
Well, actually, that feeds in something beautifully to, I got a question through my inbox the other day with someone saying, oh, you know, and I get a lot of variations on this. Sometimes it's people saying, you know, my kids are teenagers. I want to help guide them with their money, but they're not listening to me. They are teenagers. Or they'll be like, you know, my partner is not on the same page as me on money and I don't know how to work with it. Or this person I really care about, it's my friend and they could be doing better, but they're not. My perspective is you can't force someone to want to make changes with their money. I mean, how do you talk to people about it when they're busy making changes and they're seeing how it's making a difference in their life and they want to help other people that they care about? It's from a place of love. What do you do? Is there even anything you can do to help other people around you and maybe put them on a better path?
Again, I think the person has to be ready and you can only do so much. So you can, you can be a good role model. You know, I'm learning too, because I, you know, lecture my kids all the time about this, but, you know, I can lecture them till they're blue in the face. You know, maybe, and we've talked about this before we came on camera, maybe some of the things that you're, you know, suggesting or sharing might be taken on board later on down the road. If they're helpful, wonderful. But again, you're limited in your ability to shift people's transform their behaviors. because ultimately they have to be ready to want to change. And so that's tricky, you know, and you can only do what you can manage, you know. And so, again, it's being realistic about what you can offer and where the person is at and where they're going to meet you.
Yeah. I'm always a big believer in, and I mean, money and substance abuse problems aren't always the same, but, you know, it's like when they say about going to rehab, you can't necessarily force someone to rehab. They have to want to go. And then they're ready to make changes. And I think it's very much the same with any sort of life change. If someone wants to make that change and they're coming to you and talking to you about it, great. Give them resources. Tell them what's worked for you. Until then, I think very much what you were saying in terms of like being a role model of living your own best life, not in a braggy way, like don't be a douche, but, you know, if you are living a good life, you're clearly building security for yourself, you're doing it in a way that fits with your values, then I think there will be some people who look at that and say, oh, I would quite like that. How are you doing it? There will be other people who say, good for you, not for me. And you've just got to let them live their lives. It's kind of where I land on it. What do you make of that?
You can be the change that you want to see in the world, right? So if the change you want to see in the world is to help people have better habits with money or be a happier person or be a more generous person, you do that. You know, you do that. You do you. And then if people find that that is a good example for them, you'll know because they're coming to you, right? Which is where you're at now. Like people are turning to you for guidance or advice or information. So you know that you're doing a good thing. And only you know, how authentic you are in your own construction of that reality. Again, in a professional capacity, you have to draw a limit. You know, it's trickier when you got families, you know, involved because that the lines are a bit blurrier there. But, you know, I'm sure even with you and your family unit too, you're like the go-to guru on things. And so that's great, you know.
Sometimes. What is it? I always talk about wiped bum syndrome. If someone's ever wiped your bum, they're not going to listen to you. So older generations know.
Well, you're probably
younger
right
generations
there.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. That's another title for the next book.
Yeah, Penguin would love that if I suggest that to them. Hey guys, I've got a new title
for
the book.
Who's wiped your bum?
Oh, Lord. All right. Hey, if someone came to you and they, you know, they are actually, they're coming to you, they are wanting to make changes and they just say, look, I am bad with money and I don't know where to start. I'm bad with money. Here's where we're at. What would be some of the first steps you would take with them?
I think I'd sort of challenge them on that notion in the first conversation about, okay, what makes you think you're bad with money, right? So kind of find out what the psychology is and then get into the mechanics of it and say, okay, well, let's lift up the hood. Okay, so what's the reality of your situation, right? And how do you, you know, and then you get to the next stage. It's like, okay, well, you're in the poo here. So how are we going to get you out if that's the case? And where do you want to be? You know, and then lay down a pathway to how to get there. Right. And so, I mean, I'm new on this journey as well. So I'm learning, you know, some people need sharp lessons. Other people are going to need more time. You know, the likelihood of making those transformations will be entirely dependent on their commitment and willingness to change. So if they've got that in place, great. They're going to see a wonderful, you know, transformation. If not, you know, they might be struggling just, you know, for some time with weights that are holding them back. But again, you know, they've got to come to that realization themselves. So again, everybody's going to be different, but starts with a simple conversation and then looking at their position, trying to get them to draw out of them where they would like to be. And then planning, you know, some slow, methodical steps and incremental changes. I'm a big fan of that James Clear book, Atomic Habits. You know, I think people have the idea it's got to be like this big sweeping overnight thing. It's seldom going to be this big transformation. It's going to be slow, little, you know, mindset changes or different little habits that are put in place over time that tend to make the most enduring, sustainable changes.
Yeah, oh, I'm so with you on that. It's really funny because I would talk about, you know, little changes you can make with your money. Everyone kept saying to me, have you read Atomic Habits? And I was just like, no, I haven't got around to it yet. Finally read it. Such a good book. He communicated it so well. Look, if there was one money myth that you could smash right now and you think it would help the most people just get this myth out of their minds, what would it be?
That you are not separate from your money. Money is not separate. It's part of you. It's part of your psychology. It's your relationship with money. So you've got to like look inward to see what your outlook is and then see where money fits into there and stop looking at money like it is some foreign object that has to be invested in the right way to achieve this kind of wealth. It's like, let's bring it back home to the basics. What have you done with the resources that you've attracted into your life? How have you made those resources? Is the manner in which you've, you know, created your own wealth to date something that makes you joy or something that brings you kind of misery or sadness? And just flip it on them.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good note to leave it on. Thank you so much, Amanda Morrell. Now, of course, she is a financial coach, so great stuff there. I know a lot of financial psychology has gone really well on this channel. If you want more, we can always bring her back. Until next time, though, hit subscribe on Making Sense. Send this episode to a friend if it was helpful to you. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.